Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this afternoon. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information at 1-800-492-5538 or www.umm.edu/Women's Center, wherever you are in the country, 800-492-5538, University of Women's Health. And we join our conversation now. We have covered the Chicago teacher strike from the very first day with people from Chicago and all over, not because just about the strike, though it did have a lot to do with the future of unions, but also because this strike really illuminated a battle over what education should mean in America. And so people were riveted by that, those of us who care about education and our children. We are joined in the aftermath of the strike, settled, by two people to discuss what that strike meant, what the future holds, and what the debates, what are the issues are that face not just Chicago students, but students across the country, especially in urban America. We are joined by Stacey Davis Gates. She is legislative director for the Chicago Teachers Union, the CTU, and Jason Richwine, senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. And Stacey and Jason, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump on our Facebook pages. We'll see what you have to say. 410-319-8888. Stacey, let me just first turn to you. I mean, if you can outline what happened, because once these strikes are over, then we'll get into the heart of the matter of what they stand for, what came out of this, and what battles still remain around education. But everybody claims victory. That's the politics of it, right?
It is the politics of it. You know, I accept that. But I would caution people to try and pit one person as a winner and the other person as a loser, because if anything, that's not the lesson we should take away from this. What I think is most significant is that we take away that teachers make up a teachers union, and that to posit a union as something arcane and status quo is very dangerous, because you saw teachers, paraprofessionals, social workers, counselors, clinicians advocating for something quite different than status quo. So, you know, if anything you take away from this, that we not only stand in the gap in the classroom, we stand in the gap for good school policy.
So, and that's where the kind of heart of it is. I think the people who covered the strike, most of the media that I read, didn't really get to the heart of the issue is beyond pay and teachers saying they didn't want to work a longer day. I mean, that was what was in the media.
I think that was easy, right? That was something that people who don't have a deep understanding of the issues, that was immediately accessible to them. It would take a bit of context to, you know, get to the other issues. And as the week wore on and, you know, the media personnel were in the city and talking to teachers, you saw more in-depth analysis of the issues. The teacher voice kind of shone through some of the stories, in that they see this as a fight for justice more than anything. In the school system that is overwhelmingly black and brown and poor, you have to talk about, you know, issues of economics, issues of race that, you know, confound the city, and that teachers are on the front lines of that.
So, Jason, let me bring you into this conversation. I'm curious what you and the listeners, 410-319-8888, think about this. I think you would not deny this was a very important moment in the battle over education. Wouldn't you agree?
I would also say that I think that the unions largely won this debate. I think that it's kind of surprising, actually, to me. When I first saw this strike begin, I thought the union had no legs to stand on. They already have salaries and benefits that are excessive. They have one of the shortest work days. They don't want to be judged based on their student performance. I thought all those things would be losers in this sort of the political context, but apparently I'm wrong. Apparently the city largely caved to a lot of their demands. it's interesting that your guest mentioned that this is a question of justice. I would ask, justice for whom? It sounds like justice for ineffective teachers. That's essentially what's happening here. Teachers who are labeled as needs improvement or developing can stay in the classroom perpetually with this agreement. So to me, I'd like to know who exactly is being considered when we talk about issues of justice in education.
Well, let's get to that. But let me ask you a question, what you just said, and then come back to Stacey. And I'm going to raise some of the issues you raised, because I think the issues you raised, Jason, are the issues that surround the heart and soul of the battle over what education means, public education means in America. But you said one thing. Let me just get to that, and I'll come right back to Stacey. One expression you just said made was excessive salaries. What is an excessive salary for a teacher?
Well, I think what we all want is that for teachers and all public sector workers to be paid a fair market wage. In other words, if they took their skills into the private sector and they worked similar work, that's what they would be paid. If you look at the data, teachers are paid far, far more than that. One of the best ways of looking at that, actually, is looking at what happens when teachers leave the classroom or when they leave the profession. There's a lot of anecdotes about how teachers are constantly sort of tempted to leave for the private sector for higher salaries. But in fact, only about 1% of teachers ever actually leave the profession for a different field. And on average, they make less when they leave the profession.
So does that mean they shouldn't make the salary they're making? They're making too much money, you're saying?
Yes.
You think teachers make too much money?
Yes. When you look at the retirement benefits, that's the main thing. On a national level, the salaries are not particularly high. The average salary for a teacher nationwide is about $55,000. But you have to include the retirement and health benefits. Let me just use Chicago as an example. Chicago teachers who retired last year with 30 years of service retired with a pension of about $77,000 per year, plus cost of living increases for the rest of their life.
Including health benefits, that includes.
I would dispute that number roundly.
But that's pension benefits.
Well, wait a minute. So Stacey, how would you dispute that? Go ahead.
Well, we know here in Chicago that the average pensioner is only collecting about $43,000 a year. So I dispute those numbers completely.
The reason why the average pension number is low is because it includes teachers who had short careers, and it also includes teachers who retired long ago when pension benefits were lower. The most direct comparison of retirement benefits for public and private workers is to look at the public sector for teachers who worked a full career. That's the reason why you see this.
Well, and you might
difference.
Also be including in that number administrators who were once teachers, so when they became administrators, their salary became significantly higher. But the average teacher pension is about $43,000, and added to that, our pensioners do not receive Social Security, so this is their sole source of income.
They don't receive Social Security.
No, they do not receive Social Security here in Illinois.
So one last thing about this. I don't want to get stuck on the retirement benefits, which we can come back to, which I know is going to be a huge issue we will be covering, because it's the boogeyman for many state and city and federal workers is the question of retirement. So, but one quick question about that. I mean, and to Jason, Stacey can come back and respond. What is wrong with a teacher or a public servant retiring on whether it's $40,000, $50,000, or $60,000 a year? Why is that wrong?
Well, what you want to do is make sure that the overall compensation package is equivalent to the private sector. If it's more than that,
why?
Because if it's more than that, then you're essentially wasting taxpayer money. What you want to do is you want to set the compensation high enough that you recruit and retain the right people so that they don't have some better, you know, option in the private sector. But beyond that, to pay more than that is just to use taxpayer money inefficiently.
Stacey? And why do you think it's just?
Here's the thing. We know, let's just deal in facts. We know that the average pensioner who retires from Chicago Public Schools collect $42,000 a year. We know that this is their only source of income. We know that those who retire with a higher pension are those who also became administrators, either in the central office or building level administrators. Those are facts that we know. I also find it almost laughable that those who contribute to their retirement with every paycheck on a regular schedule have to basically be insulted for, you know, collecting their own retirement. They contribute to it, they are taxpayers, and they've done the job. You know, you have people who've served the public, their students, for 30-plus years. So, frankly, that argument is completely lost on me. Let me try, then we talk about this comparison with the private sector. We also know that our teachers are highly qualified. So not only do they stay in the classroom, but they also refine their craft by going back to school and getting advanced degrees, master's degrees or doctorate degrees as well. We know that. We also know that our teachers are faced with hours. I think I heard some hour that we have the shortest day. There was actually a study done on our school day because obviously it's been of great interest here in Chicago. Well, we two things about that. The first thing is that it was found that our work hours are not always reflected in a punch in, punch out. We found that after school hours and weekend hours go well beyond what is always addressed and talked about. So in terms of what we see being paid out and the amount of work that teachers put in, it's laughable, even what the argument is a buttress on, okay? The second thing about that is that the school day argument in terms of the amount of hours Chicago children are actually in school, I think Jonah Edelman, the founder of Stanford Children, when he was at the Aspen Institute, I think it was the summer of 2010, he said that that was just something that they gave the mayor to campaign on, that was not based or founded in any type of research, and that it was a campaign slogan.
So, Jason, go ahead very quickly, and I'm going to move to another subject.
There's a lot there to respond to. Let me respond quickly because there's a lot to say. First of all, just to get back to the pension payment again, if you worked for 10 years at IBM, would you compare the retirement benefits you get from IBM to someone who worked 30 years at another company? That's essentially what's going on when you look at the average pension payment without adjusting for how many years you work. As I said, a 30-year career, which I guess passes for a full career in the public sector, someone gets $77,000. That comes directly from the reports from the Chicago pension plans themselves. It's true, there's no Social Security there, but a lot of people have a misunderstanding about that. If you're a middle-class worker, it's good to not be in Social Security. Social Security pays a negative rate of return for middle-class.
Well, as a middle-class worker, I'm thankful for mine. Well, I've got to tell you, it adds a lot at the end of the month.
you're losing money on it, or at least
right.
I'm not sure how old you are.
And I and a lot of others lost a ton by putting it in the private market when it crashed. Many people in America lost their entire savings in that crash.
Well, of course, there are annuities and things that allow people to hedge against that. But the point is that Social Security is a bad deal for middle-class workers. It's good not to have to participate. I would love, as a young person, not to have to participate myself. Your guest mentioned paying into the pension fund. Teachers in Chicago put 2% of their salary into the pension fund each year. That's not exactly a huge amount of money. She also mentioned that teachers are highly qualified because they have advanced degrees. All of the research indicates that advanced degrees make no difference whatsoever in how much students learn. This is something that is practically unanimous among economists who have looked at this. And yet, nevertheless, the teachers' unions have celebrated the fact that they have maintained no merit pay in this contract, and they will be continuing to be paid for completely meaningless degrees like degrees in education. Again, I want to underline this for your listeners because it's very important. Things like years of experience beyond the first few years and things like master's degrees have no impact on what students learn. Yet,
that is absolutely unfounded.
Nonetheless.
So to say that a person who has studied their craft, right, gotten advanced training, and has been in the classroom for years has no impact on student achievement, completely untrue.
Read the literature.
I've read the literature, and I think you're talking about maybe two studies.
It is one of the most unanimous studies.
And those studies were not done by education professionals, but economists.
So let me ask another question here. I'm going to get beyond, leave the money aspect for a minute, the salaries, and talk about what I think you also mentioned, Jason, that many people have talked about, which I've had many email conversations about here with people in Baltimore and around the country, which has to do with the question of evaluations, standardized tests, and the future of public education in America. I think that to me is the crux of a lot of this that didn't get a lot of play other than to say that the teachers did not want to be evaluated primarily on standardized testing. So then let's talk about that, because that ended up I do think states that ends up in the teachers' in the union's favor when this ended in terms of the contract that was negotiated. But to me, that's at the core, a part of the core of the debate over public education and what we mean by education. So let me start with Jason and your take on that, then we'll go to Stacey.
I agree. Teacher evaluation is a big thing, and I think even some people on the left, even a lot of Democrats like Rahm Emanuel, are finally starting to come around to the idea that evaluating teachers based on how much their students learn is a good idea and should be done. The objection to it is often heard that, well, of course, there are many factors other than teacher impact that affect whether a student learns something or not. You have, of course, just whether a student is smart or not, or his home circumstances, economic circumstances, and all of that is true, which is why the value-added models, the value-added assessments that are used to score teachers, take all of that into account. They have pre-tests and they have post-tests to make sure that it's not looking at the effect of past teachers. It also controls for economic factors, demographic factors, to really get an isolated impact of teacher effectiveness. And, of course, it's not perfect, but it's much, much better than the old system, which bases teacher pay strictly on experience and education, which, as I just said, has nothing to do with student achievement.
Let's talk about student achievement and what the union was talking about when it came to standardized tests and what that perspective is. Stacey?
Well, our perspective is that merit pay, fending off merit pay was actually a win for us. That was a significant win for us. And a lot of this education reform that's going on nationally, a lot of the larger cities were force-fed merit pay. We know that incentivizing education for educators deals with agency in one's day and being developed in a way that makes sense to their classroom. That's what incentivizes our teachers. So what you hear with merit pay is what works in the private sector with money managers should also be applied to those in the education sector, and this is what's going to motivate us and make us close this gap and our students will achieve. Two different things. We're not motivated by the same things. We're motivated by agency in our day and being able to develop our craft and develop our students in a certain way. So if you want to incentivize teachers, you have to actually understand that. Two, the value-added method that's being talked about is highly unreliable, and we know that. We also know that standardized test scores are only but so reliable. We know that, especially with African-American and Latino students, that it depends on your zip code, right? So if you have an African-American student, a Latino student, who lives in a more affluent suburb, let's say they live in a more affluent suburb, those students, as compared to their white counterparts, they'll still score below their white counterparts on that test score. They will every single time. Because what that test does is prove your zip code or your parents' income level. Nothing more than that. Teachers are not afraid of evaluation. What teachers are afraid of is that evaluations will be misapplied. They will be used wrongly. No, you will not get one person who creates any of these standardized tests to tell you that this test should be used to evaluate the effectiveness of a teacher, to evaluate the effectiveness of the school, or even to evaluate the effectiveness of a student. What those test scores tell you is a benchmark. They give you a benchmark, what they know, what they don't know, and where you can work from. Teachers do this all the time in their classrooms. We benchmark. We figure out where our students enter and where they end. And in between, we take more benchmarks to figure out how we need to adjust or refine practice within that classroom. No one is afraid of evaluation. What we are very apprehensive and concerned about is how these things are being used in the classroom and how collaborative this process can be. You will not find a teacher who will tell you that I don't need to understand where my kids are and where I need to take my kids and how effective my particular instruction has been on the students. That's why there's a great need for collaboration amongst teachers who teach the same students to understand what type of instructional practices work best with that student. We are trying to conform education to a science that's more readily understood by an economist or a businessman, instead of trying to get the businessman or the economist to understand the particularities of the education profession, right?
So,
I'm sorry.
I just want to let Jason kind of have a response. Jason, in this battle over how you evaluate education, talk to me about where you think standardized tests fit and how that fits into a teacher's evaluation, how it fits into a student's life, and what it's done to our schools so far.
Well, I think that should be a big part of it. I just said earlier that the demographic and economic factors are controlled. That's one of the major things that they do in order to try to isolate the impact of teachers. Yet your guest immediately started talking about economic and social factors that might influence these things. That is controlled for, and the tests are reliable enough to predict from year to year how well teachers do. Your guest also made some kind of claim about perhaps test not reflecting actual ability or something like that, that if a black student does poorly on a math test, that means he may still know a lot of math. I don't understand that at all. That's not what you said.
I didn't understand that point.
But the bottom line is, if teachers want to be evaluated, if they're not afraid of evaluation, why not embrace something that specifically tries to isolate their impact on achievement?
But why do you think, what I'm asking Jason is this, I mean, that the years I've been covering education and was in education, looking at schools, private and public and parochial. I mean, we have never had a system I can remember in our country where standardized tests were the basis or the largest factor in evaluating how successful a student is or how successful a teacher is.
Well, and I think you can look at the track record of public education. It hasn't been very good lately. I think this is one of the reasons why we have so many reformers on both the right and the left, I should add. I want to emphasize again, Rahm Emanuel is a Democrat. Even President Obama has been...
Oh, no, this is clearly... This standardized testing idea is beyond ideological trappings of liberalism or conservatism.
It is, absolutely. And I think that... The more it's used in the teacher evaluation, the better we can get a sense of who the good teachers are. After all, I mean, at the end of the day, I think we can all agree we want good teachers in the classroom and bad teachers to not be in the profession. Can we agree on that?
What I will say is that this bad teacher mythology
permeates
Hollywood movies and quick sound bites from politicians. What we do know is that the issues that plague a low-income, urban school environment is very different from the measurements that are being offered up. So let's just rewind. When the achievement gap was closing in America between students of color and white students, there was a vast amount of resources inputted into the schools. We have to look no further than the Great Society programs. It has been posited by researchers that if we would have continued with the same sort of robust investment into urban schools that happened in the 1970s into the very early 80s, that we wouldn't have the opportunity or the achievement gap that we have now in schools. In fact, we know that the achievement gap in math and in literacy closed. We also know that African American students graduated from high school at a higher rate, and also entered and graduated from college at a higher rate. So what I would say is that this rush to test, to know something that you already know, is that there needs to be more resources inputted. Teachers need to be supported. In countries where students are achieving at a very higher rate, we know that the teachers are supported. We know that they're giving resources. And we know that we look at education a lot differently. Here in America, what we are doing is we're looking for a product that's easily transferred into the business world. Instead of providing the type of resources and concentration into education to get a holistic student to come out of it.
So
go ahead.
Yeah, no, Jason, I'm going to have a chance to respond.
Calling for more investment. The idea that there was some kind of heyday of public education spending in the 60s that we don't have now is completely false. Education spending has gone up and up and up and up. The per pupil spending now is something, what, $13,000 per student, $25,000 per student in D.C. It goes up and up and up. It's been going up for a very long time. And at that same time period, scores are flat because the money is not going to productive ends. It's going to excessive retirement benefits. It's going to more and more administrators. The ratio of administrators to students has gone up and up and up. Same with the class sizes, down and down and down. Yet, somehow, we haven't translated all that money into significantly higher scores. But the claim from teachers' unions still is more money, more money. It will always be more money. What reformers are saying is, let's stop with the more money, more money, more money. Start holding schools actually accountable for how they're using the money with these kinds of evaluations.
And I don't think the reformers are saying stop the money. In fact, I think the reformers are saying give the testing companies the money, because we've seen an uptick in the amount of money that the testing companies are getting, because out of all of the reform policy that's been passed, the testing companies have seen a significant uptick in their revenue stream.
So we have to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back with Stacey Davis-Gates and Jason Richwine to continue our discussion about what the Chicago teacher strike and settlement says about the larger issues facing education in urban America. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. mecu.com for Baltimore's credit union, or go up to steinershow.org and click on its banner on our website. We are here with Stacey Davis-Gates, Legislative Director for the Chicago Teachers Union, and Jason Richwine, Senior Policy Analyst for Heritage Foundation. 410-319-8888 is the number. So, let me, Jason, had you finished your thought before we went to break?
I believe so. Okay.
Go ahead. So, I'm very curious as to the vision that both of you have about what the future of education in America, especially urban America, looks like, and what this strike and what this battle over Chicago schools says to that, and how that relates to that or speaks to that. And I say that because, you know, when you look at education in the 21st century, we're looking at a very different kind of situation than we had in America ever before. I mean, you know, you had in the 50s and 60s, people went to school. Not everybody was a scholar. People graduated, they didn't graduate, but like here in Baltimore or in Pittsburgh or in many other cities, there were steel mills, there were the Maryland Dry Dock, there were the wharfs, there were factories. People went to work. You had the end of segregation. I'll tell the story, I'll tell it here again, that there was a conversation with several people who had all graduated from a school called Douglas High School, which was the only high school in the Baltimore area that black folks could go to. Up until the 60s, well, in the 50s, but really up until the 60s for the most part. And that when you ask people who graduated from the high school, who made up the foundation of the black middle class, how many people were in your school, the response was, I'm not sure, 400, 500, 600 maybe. Well, during that period, there were thousands and thousands of black children then that never went to high school, didn't go to high school. Segregation left a lot of people behind in the deindustrialization. So there are a lot of folks whose fathers, mothers, grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents never went to school and now have no jobs. How does that affect education in urban America? And how does all the stuff anybody's talking about fit into defining and redefining what it means for an educational system to fit what's happening in America in the 21st century? And I'm curious how you both respond. I know it's a long-winded, I apologize. And I'll let you go at it first, then go to Stacey.
Well, I think just to sort of respond first to the first part of your question about where do I see public education going, I do think that the reformers have it right, and I think that I hope that public education moves more in the direction of being responsible with the public's money, using teacher evaluations, using merit pay and the like to emulate the way a business would work. You take an input and you expect a certain output for it. But I think getting to your point about more people going to high school and more people graduating and all, I think what's indicating is the greater need for specialization. You know, the one-size-fits-all idea. You know, everyone should get a high school degree. Everyone should get a college degree. I think that's really serving our students not so well, because people have different abilities. They have different interests. They have different things they'd like to do. So specialization to me, you know, whether it's you're going to a vocational track or an academic track or an internship or you name it, it's something that the public schools don't do a very good job of really providing at this point. You know, there's this thought here that everyone should go to college or everyone should be on this particular track. To me, the real future here involving education specialization is having more choice in terms of what kinds of schools you go to, what kinds of emphases are put on various courses and things in those schools. Charter schools, for example, vouchers, tax credits. I think that's the future, because that's what allows us to sort of adapt to changing economic circumstances much better than the public schools, which are really sort of a fossil, you know, of a bygone era.
Stacy?
What I would say is that this week with Chicago, I'm very encouraged by the pushback that teachers can give to this education deform, is what we're calling it. Even after this contract fight, we have 160 schools here in Chicago without libraries, and the bulk of those schools reside on the west and south sides of our city. We have schools that do not have play lots. We have schools that run year-round but do not have proper heating or air conditioning. So to say that resourcing these schools should not be at the top of the list is an understatement. We're also experiencing here a loss of legacy and infrastructure in the neighborhood. We close schools down here in Chicago like nobody's business. And by closing these schools down, we are further destabilizing environments that have already been destabilized by high unemployment, basically by poverty. So poverty does matter. And I think we need to get that about education in America, that poverty matters and that race matters, and that by sidestepping these issues or manipulating the civil rights arguments, that we're actually doing something good. Here in Chicago, we know that black and brown teachers who choose to come to Chicago and teach, or who choose to stay at home and teach, that they teach in schools that are high poverty and whose achievement has traditionally been low. We also know that as a result of the types of school actions or the reforms that are being enacted here, that those teachers are the first ones to go. So in 2000, we have 40% of our system had African-American teachers. 10 years later, it was only at 19%. That destabilizes the black middle class and the overall middle class in the city as well. That, too, is a problem. We know only 1.7% of the teachers in our system are African-American males. That is a profound issue as well. We know that there are still manufacturing jobs out there. They're just not located here in America or located in the inner core of our cities anymore. There has to be an investment in urban America again. The people who live in urban centers have to become a priority again. Poverty matters. We know that a family of four that makes $60,000 here in Chicago, they're barely making it. So when we hear people talk about this high income that we make as teachers here in Chicago, it's almost laughable, because our teachers have families as well. It's expensive to live here. So we know that poverty does matter here in Chicago and across this country. And the biggest issue that we have to deal with here is the fact that our teachers want to be collaborators. They don't want to get into the back and forth. It is a shame, actually, that for 7 days our teachers were on strike and not in the classroom. It is a shame that our establishment here.
Okay, let Stacy finish this thought.
Look to the experts.
And Jason, what were you trying to say?
Your guest again made the case.
Stacy, yeah.
Unions always make the case for more money. More money, more money. It's amazing to me. If, you know, she notes, you know, heaters not working and not having libraries. Where is the money going? The money goes up and up. Chicago now spends, what, $13,000, $14,000, $15,000 per student? Where is that money going if there's not even heaters in the classroom?
Average is around a little less than $10,000. It's like $9,800-something.
What reformers want to do is make schools accountable for how they spend this money, so that we don't have the situation where money disappears into a...
That's actually where he and I can agree. That the priorities of our board here have come into question by us as well. here in Chicago, our school system is ran by our mayor, and he gets to appoint his board of education. So we actually have some commonality there in that teachers are not responsible for setting the budget, approving the budget, and making sure that those budgetary priorities are done in the way in which they were intended. So that does, we do agree on that, because certainly we have an issue with the budgetary priorities. Because all of the things that we know that work, smaller class sizes promote higher achievement. Smaller class sizes promote graduation rates and communities of low-income students. So we know that works.
Say something, I'll interrupt you because I want to give Jason a chance to have his say in here before we have to break for Wycliffe John coming in the studio. But what I want to ask you, Jason, if you comment on what Stacey was just saying, what you were trying to say earlier. I mean, every urban school system in the country, suburban as well, but especially every urban school system in the country, has the same issues with no libraries, the infrastructure falling apart, no heat and electricity. Whether I'm visiting the Detroit system or the D.C. system or Oakland or Baltimore, it's all the same. I mean, and so you don't think that that investment is needed to have? I mean, it's going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars for this country to do that, but is that not an investment that needs to be made?
No. It suggests that the money that's already been invested, which is a huge amount of money, has obviously not been spent optimally. The things it has been spent on are hiring administrators who don't.
I'm going to interrupt. I do want you to answer the question, but almost all the time in any kind of urban school budget or school budget period, there are two separate budgets. One goes to inside the classroom and what the administration would pay, and there's a totally separate budget when it comes to the infrastructure of the schools. That's what's not being funded.
Well, look, I mean, the money is all coming ultimately from the same place. It's coming from taxpayers. So,
well, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah. But so ultimately, you know, the money needs to be spent more wisely. I mean, that's sort of obvious. Stacey mentioned, class sizes. That's one of the worst investments you can make. The cost-benefit there is ridiculously bad. What we should be doing is having larger classes taught only by the best teachers. When you reduce class size, it has tremendous
costs.
There's
absolutely no research to substantiate that.
Stacey, let me let Jason.
Smaller class size research is overwhelming.
If I can make the point I was trying to make before. Reducing class size has minor impacts on certain students in certain cases when the class sizes are very small. The cost of getting to that point for the average student is incredible. That money could be much, much better spent on finding the best teachers, getting rid of the worst teachers, getting the best teachers, and actually having larger classes in some cases so that you can teach students in a much more cost-effective manner. Stacey also mentioned earlier something I think is rather revealing about the way unions operate. She mentioned that it's crucial that more black men become teachers in Chicago. Now, to me, I thought that education policy was about teaching students. But to her, it sounds like it's a make-work program, including an affirmative action make-work program for certain types of people.
Well, why would
don't
you
just have the best teachers rather than picking a particular demographic group to try to include? That's the kind of thinking that unions go through here. It's not about the students. It's about unions and protecting union jobs.
Let me qualify. I taught high school for 12 years, so let me qualify that. So I'm not speaking from which I've read. I'm speaking from which I know. And so I do know from teaching in places like Englewood and teaching in places like Humboldt Park that kids having a person in front of them that's culturally competent and familiar with from where they come from and can relate to them in a certain way and role model from to them, it means something. We also know that the overwhelming majority of teachers who are from white middle-class environments only remain in the profession for 5 years maximum, and that those who come from the same culture as their students typically remain there and will retire from that profession. So these are things that we do know. And then I would challenge you.
Stacey, I'm sorry.
If you ever have 40 students in a kindergarten classroom, I would love for you to go visit a Detroit kindergarten classroom.
But Stacey Davis-Gates, Legislative Director of Chicago Teachers Union, and Jason Richwine, Senior Policy Analyst at Heritage Foundation. Very lively discussion. Thank you both so much for being with us. And we'll come back to this and look forward to continuing it.
Thank you.
Thank you both.